Rebecca Traister's new book, Big Girls Don't Cry, captures the drama of the 2008 presidential election when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama battled for the Democratic nomination. Traister was a reluctant, then enthusiastic supporter of Hillary Clinton and credits Clinton with changing the politics of the time and the press that covers it. She gives high marks to people like Katie Couric and Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, and Rachel Maddow. She calls out Chris Matthews, Tucker Carlson, Ken Rudin, and other male commentators for their sexist remarks about Hillary Rodham Clinton. Well, as we all know, Clinton lost, but Rebecca Traister says the race was good for women. Case in point, the number of women running for election this year. Her book is subtitled The Election That Changed Everything for American Women, and Rebecca Traister is a senior writer at Salon.com, and it's a great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a great pleasure to be here on Radio Times.
So should all the Republican women running for office this year thank Hillary Rodham Clinton for helping open the door for them?
The funny thing is many of them do. I have heard Christine O'Donnell drop Hillary's name several times on the campaign trail. And Sarah Palin, we have to remember, one of the most surprising things that I write about this in the book is that the moment Sarah Palin was introduced to the country as this incredibly conservative nominee for the Republican ticket for vice president, she cited Hillary Clinton in her first speech and Geraldine Ferraro. She was totally unashamed, and this is a new model, and this is one of the things that I think was groundbreaking about Sarah Palin, totally unashamed to place herself in the pantheon of history-making political women. And by the way, she was right to do so. She was only the second woman ever nominated on a major ticket for vice president. But in that introductory speech, she said, I want to shout out, you know, make shout outs to Hillary Clinton and to Geraldine Ferraro, which was astounding to hear a Republican crowd clap for that.
Well, let me go back, and it feels almost like ancient history to be talking about the 2008 presidential campaign. But nonetheless, in your book, you talk about Mark Penn, who was supporting and also advising Hillary Clinton. And his advice to her was, you know, act more like Margaret Thatcher, mm-hmm. right? In a sense, be one of the guys while you're campaigning. Help us understand, I guess, I mean, obviously, I don't know if that was a failed strategy, but nonetheless, that's what she was told.
Well, it was not. In the case of Hillary Clinton, it turned out not to be a winning strategy, and that's for a lot of reasons, a lot of factors. But what it was a strategy that relied on old but reliable conventional wisdom, which was, I mean, we like to pretend that we're sort of over gender and over, you know, we've gotten to a place where we've fixed a lot of our gender problems, our race problems. We don't like to linger a lot on this. But the fact is, we have had for decades, for hundreds of years, tremendous trouble electing women. It is very rare for women to run for high office. And so the wisdom has been, if you're going to be a woman running for high office, you have to essentially be able to pass as male, whether that means that you need to be a hawk, whether it means you cannot talk about yourself as a woman. You're encouraged not to, you know, fly any kind of feminist flag, certainly. You're really encouraged to play down your difference. And so that's part of the playbook that Mark Penn was working from. And it wasn't a crazy one. I mean, this is what history has told us, that this country has not been warm to history-making women who declare themselves as such, which is one of the things that was so surprising about how Palin entered the race with such a self-celebratory bang. And so when Hillary followed that advice, She indeed talked about like decking patsies and I'm in it to win it, and she had this very pugilistic. She didn't mention the fact that there was something that was different about her from the mm-hmm. rest of the 10 Democratic candidates standing up on those debate stages, and that wasn't working for her. But part of the reason we also have to take into account is that her chief rival in the Democratic field was Barack Obama, a candidate who was also trying not to play up the fact that he was African American, but his tack was to take a very female approach to the electorate. So if you listen to Barack Obama's speeches, they were full of, I feel you, our hopes, our dreams, our wishes in my heart, I know you, very female language. He had Oprah, the sort of women's guru, advising him on his campaign. So there was actually another candidate out there eating Hillary's lunch when it came to talking about the female. So it's a bunch of complicated dynamics.
Well, and I'm even thinking of some of those debates when it was Hillary Clinton in this row of male Democratic candidates. And I would say in many of those debates, she was the winner in that she knew her stuff. She knew how to answer questions. She could fight back under the handcuffs of these debating, these various debates. But she was one of the guys, was she not?
Oh, well, she was one of the guys in that she was one of the competent politicians on stage. And in many of those debate cases, I think, inarguably, the most competent or able to express herself most skillfully. Hillary Clinton is a tough, good, smart, competent politician. But I was frustrated at the time. I was not a Hillary Clinton supporter going into the race in my personal life. But I did write about women in politics. So, of course, she was sort of my beat. This was the biggest story about women in politics in 220 years of American history. So, of course, I was paying very close attention. And I was deeply frustrated as a young woman with the fact that there was no acknowledgement and there was a kind of willful lack of acknowledgement that Hillary was different and that there was something exciting, dramatic, and history-making about her place on that stage. And so the funny thing, my memories of those debate stages with like 10 guys in dark suits and then Hillary in some jewel-toned, ill-advised, but actually rather fabulous pantsuit, was that I wanted the recognition, and there were even some instances in which there were arguably sexist comments made about her outfits by the other candidates. John Edwards at some point sort of said, "I don't know about that jacket," and then Barack weighed in and said, "I like the jacket," and you were thinking, "Oh my God, they're talking about her outfit in the middle of a debate." But there was something that was freeing and a relief about that, because it was like, yes, let's talk about the fact that she looks different from everybody else on stage, because this is big history we're making here. And she's big history. Let's talk about why and how we view women differently. And so that stage in which she was trying to pass as one of the guys was also, I found it a very constraining stage as a voter, as a woman, as somebody who was writing about the process. I wanted there to be a discussion of what was unusual about this.
Well, and I certainly remember hosting numbers of programs about this race, these candidates, and tapping into a lot of anger of women who felt like they wanted Hillary Clinton to win. Obviously, they wanted to vote for her, but they felt, you know, who is this interloper, that this usurper who is coming in and stealing the stage from a first legitimate, and by that I mean someone that really looked like they had the power to win this race, someone that was going to take it away from her.
You mean an interloper in Barack Obama?
Exactly.
Well, there was that sentiment, and it tapped into a lot of old history and a lot of old resentments that I think that had to do with the intersections of race and gender and social progress, again, extending back not just to 2008, but to the mid-20th century social movements, the civil rights, anti-war, and women's movement, which ostensibly were all fighting for freedoms for more individuals, but often left large groups of the other individuals out and created resentments further back to that, to the 19th century split between former allies, abolitionists and suffragists, over the 14th and 15th Amendments and who was going to be enfranchised. Those amendments after the Civil War were going to enfranchise and grant citizenship to black men and not women of any color. And there was an incredible split between abolitionists and suffragists. And this is part of how history, not just in America, all around the world, but in American history, how power replicates itself, how exclusive power replicates itself, which is that when a seat becomes available at a table, those who've been barred from that table are set against each other. And there was just as much resentment from men and women who supported Barack Obama, who felt that Hillary was coming in as an establishment character, an establishment
part of
candidate,
a
dynasty candidate, and she was the old boys network. Now, in retrospect, it is impossible to suggest that with 2 centuries plus American history without a woman getting even within spitting distance of a nomination for the presidency, that any woman was an establishment candidate. But you can see how those resentments also tied back into a history in which, you know, again, in the mid-19th century, Frederick Douglass argued about his former allies. He'd been at Seneca Falls. You know, he was a suffragist himself. But he argued white women have always been closer to power because they have had associations with white men who have had the power. Mm. And that's actually, you could hear the echoes of that in the resentments toward Hillary and the fact that she'd been married to a president. So we were seeing really hundreds of years of history, a can opened on them, and we were thinking about these issues with fresh characters for new reasons, but these are the issues that have both sped and impeded our path to furthered equality, inclusion, and social progress.
And where do you think those rifts are today, now just two years later?
Well, they certainly still exist. What my larger argument in the book is that the exposure, the re-exposure of these arguments, these rifts, is absolutely vital for us to work through them. I think that it's a very bad habit of ours, again, to sort of pat ourselves on the back, congratulate ourselves on how far we've come when it comes to any issue, name it, sexuality, race, ethnicity, gender, disability, and tell ourselves that we're so much better than we were 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And we do that all the time. I actually don't think that's a productive way to move forward. I think the much smarter approach, if the more difficult and often very painful and confusing approach, is to try to unpack this stuff, even though there are no clear answers. There's not anybody whose resentments were correct. There is not one correct vision of how history and prejudice weighed out against each other. But what there was an active discussion. And I do think that discussion is going on right now as we talk about issues of race and gender related to the Obama administration, related to these midterm elections. We are still having these painful conversations, and they suck. I mean, to be frank, they're really hard. And that's because what we're aiming for is a difficult balance to achieve. But I think it's crucial that we're having these conversations, and I don't think we were having them in the same way even 4 years ago.
But do you think, and even looking at the subtitle of your book, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women, changed in a good way, in a negative way, a way that opened doors, shut doors?
Well, I should clarify that it's the election that changed everything for American women, not necessarily the election that fixed anything.
Exactly.
But I do think that the change itself, the shaking up, is good. It's a some good. But part of the point I make in the book is that social progress just doesn't happen in a straight line. We'd like it to. There was a great desire, you could see if we remember the election, the inauguration of Barack Obama. We wanted to take this moment and make ourselves feel like this helped show how far beyond racism we were. We wanted to take this one individual story and say, see, we fixed our problem. There was a yearning to do that. And of course, we knew then, we know now, that it's not that simple. But I think that the having of the conversation and sharpening our sensitivity and our vocabulary about these issues, making us think differently about what is a sexist thing to say, what isn't, how are we treating women candidates, what is behind a lot of the resistance to the Obama administration, a lot of the ways we talk about Obama, all these things are crucial to having more people involved in these races, more people in positions of professional and economic opportunity and equality.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Now, Rebecca Traister is our guest, and she's written a new book. It's called Big Girls Don't Cry, and it's subtitled The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. And she covered the 2008 presidential election for Salon, and she is a senior writer at Salon, covers women in politics and the media as well. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Shipley School, an independent co-educational school pre-kindergarten through grade 12. For over 100 years, Shipley, a close community with a complete college preparatory curriculum, has been preparing students for a future of lifelong learning, personal achievement, and compassionate participation in the world. Shipley will host Shipley Today, an admissions open house, Saturday, October 30th from 9 to 11 a.m. More at shipleyschool.org or 610-525-4300. Shipley cultivates adventurous minds.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We hope to end the fall membership campaign by Friday at 5, and that will only happen if you make a pledge of support right now. That phone number, 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at whyy.org. Radio Times is just one of a number of programs produced right here at WHYY. Your support makes this kind of in-depth and informative programming possible. Make a call right now to ensure the future of WHYY and Radio Times. Thanks.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY, featuring details on upcoming events, including a lecture by abstract painter Mary Heilman on November 9th at 4:45 p.m., sponsored by Princeton University's Lewis Center for the Arts. Heilman will speak as part of a lecture series that explores the relationship between the modern artist and the concept of free time. Details at princeton.edu/arts. The Lewis Center for the Arts and more online at jerseyarts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Rebecca Traister is our guest. She's a senior writer at Salon. She's been there since 2003, covering women in politics, media, and entertainment. And she has a new book called Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women and the Election of 2008. And we have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Well, I think you were not alone when we all learned a little more than 2 years ago that John McCain had picked Sarah Palin to be his vice president. And you describe actually being out in Denver and someone waking you up and saying, did you hear the news? And you didn't know who this woman was.
No, my colleague Alex Koppelman said he picked Palin, McCain picked Palin, and the only thing I could think of was Michael Palin, the British actor and star of A Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah,
you know,
from Monty Python.
That
would have been interesting.
It would have been so much fun.
It would have been.
Unlikely, though. Yeah, no, we were Googling Sarah Palin. My colleagues from Salon and I were in a rented house where we'd been covering the Democratic convention. It was the night after Obama's remarkable speech at Mile High Stadium or whatever it's now called. And we were all sleeping late, you know, we'd been up late. And there was Sarah Palin on the television screen. And it was like the world cracked open, you know? I mean, imagine, I think all of us have a hard time imagining that night before there was Palin in the world, you know? But we were Googling her, and now in retrospect with a lot of the campaign reporting that's happened since, we know that members of the McCain team were also Googling Sarah Palin that morning, trying to figure out who their new running mate was.
But look what John McCain did. I mean, not only did he launch her, but I think perhaps you could even say helped to launch the Tea Party movement along with her.
Well, yes, I think that John McCain had absolutely no, and his team had absolutely no idea what they were unleashing on the world. And it's very interesting because at the time, even that morning as I'm Googling her, and I'd been doing a lot of writing at that point about the resentments within the Democratic Party. There was, it wasn't simply as it was portrayed, like the angry, bitter Hillary women who wanted their candidate or no one else. So there was certainly that element, and I won't deny that there was. Right. That was a very thin strain of what, in fact, was a larger resentment and frustration, again, that extended back historically, from women on the left feeling that their party, the Democratic Party, had not taken not only their candidate, but them seriously, had not acknowledged Hillary as a history-making figure, had not celebrated her, had tried to push her out of the race, had behaved in sexist ways to her. And there was a resentment that the party itself, and this did include Barack Obama to some extent, had failed to address. And so when I saw that John McCain had picked a woman, my initial response was, this is a genius move. Mm. I mean, I'm a Democrat. I had no intention of voting for her. And I could tell even from the quickest Google that I had no intention of voting for her. However, what I and I think a lot of my compatriots thought was, this is brilliant. What a great strategic move. You're bringing in a woman. You're going to be the party that is showing its respect for women. Again, she advertised herself as a historic candidate, the thing that Hillary and the Democrats had a hard time doing. It turns out that it was practically an accidental choice. I mean, revisionist reporting now shows that nobody on that team, they picked her on a whim. They were going to pick Joe Lieberman. They realized he was just too far to the left, unbelievably, for the Republicans to go for him. And so they thought she was this, you know, attractive woman, and they pretty much said as much. There was one conversation with her. There was very little background research, and boom, she was the candidate. So it wasn't a well-planned out strategic move. But it turns out to be one of the most explosive things that's happened in American politics in, I think, any of our memories.
Well, and you raise an important point, but I think a touchy one as well, whether a candidate like a Sarah Palin can either call herself a feminist or be called a feminist. And even just quoting from your book here, you say, Palin was the kind of feminist who, by dint of her large family and load-bearing husband, managed to juggle family and a burgeoning political career, but who would support no medical, health care, family leave, or labor policies that would make similar paths possible for other women. Mm-hmm. Saying that if you don't support these policies, you really can't be a feminist? Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not. My argument is it's a little dense, I'll grant you, because this is a tricky issue.
It is.
Though I would argue the fact that we are having this conversation, that this conversation has been happening in lots of places in recent weeks, months, and years, is a testament to exactly how much we've changed, because who was talking about who gets to be a feminist 4 years ago? No one, I will tell you. My argument about Sarah Palin, and in fact the group that she now calls the Mama Grizzlies, right, is that because they are calling on feminist language, they're calling themselves feminists, they talk about Susan B. Anthony, they talk about Title IX. There's no membership office for feminists. There's no sort of, you don't get ejected or deactivated or expelled from the roles or whatever if you violate some feminist principle. That is actually an anti-feminist myth that is often thrown up against feminists. It's not true, I know. So anybody who wants to call themselves a feminist obviously gets to be one.
Of course. Feminism
is ultimately a construction of language, right? But then once you're a feminist, what you're involved in is a conversation that has been going on for hundreds of years about how your ideas, how your ideology, how your policy actually serves women. And so my argument with the people who are now my fellow feminists in the right-wing Republican women calling themselves feminists is, okay, great. I am excited to talk about the ways that feminist victories have made your roles as candidates possible. However, let's talk about how your views on everything from reproductive rights to labor policy to fair pay legislation to, in some cases, wanting to abolish the EPA and the Education Department, as Sharon Engel has said, actually impact opportunity for women. Let's talk about how the work you want to do as a leader helps other women, helps them gain access to furthered opportunity. That's my argument. You can be a feminist, but that doesn't automatically mean that everything that comes out of your mouth is pro-woman, and that's the same thing. People can have that argument with me and do.
Well, and I would assume the other side is to say, but if you look at a woman who works, who's in a position of power, who has authority, frankly, over other people, that in itself is a picture of feminism and female power.
Sure it is, but that snapshot, one snapshot doesn't equal everything. When you're talking about people, and especially people who are in a position to make policy, I'm very interested, and I think it's totally authentic. I write in the book about the ways that there are things about Sarah Palin that are progressive that we cannot ignore, that are feminist victories. The load-bearing husband, you just quoted.
Exactly.
Sarah Palin's marriage from the outside appears to be a feminist ideal in that this is one of the things that feminism failed to address was domestic inequity. So if second wave feminism successfully put women in graduate schools and in some cases high-powered careers, what it had failed to do and what we have been talking about recently in recent years with the mommy wars,
yeah,
is effectively redistribute domestic work and childcare work in the home so that women were forced to work the second shift and were still forced to be the domestic load bearers in their family, making it hard for them to pursue, for example, a career in politics. Sarah Palin, to all appearances, has had a domestic partner in Todd Palin that allowed her to get to the Alaska governor's mansion at 42, becoming the youngest governor in that state with four children and then have another child in office. This is a feminist victory. And I would not try to take that away from her in any way, but I also want to have a conversation with her about how the other policy that she would put into effect would affect other women who want to have careers with four children.
Well, and it's funny, you mentioned the mommy wars, which is probably an overused phrase, but she, of course, talks about the Mama Grizzlies as sort of taking, in a sense, taking a page from some of that language, but giving it her own kind of twist.
Yes.
And these would be, obviously, the Republican women who are running for office these days and their supporters.
Yes. And again, there are mixed messages here because there is undoubtedly something compelling and progressive and ultimately feminist about the idea of combining motherhood with power, combining motherhood with professionalism and with politics. And that's a good thing. But where we have to be wary about it is where we completely resituate the idea of female power with maternal capability. Because, of course, just like it's important to acknowledge that people can simultaneously mother and govern,
right,
we also can't completely redefine this so that it means you can only govern if you're a mother and have managed a household. That's, you know, so this is part of the process of moving forward, is sorting through these mixed messages.
Well, let me quote something else, and this is actually a piece you had recently in The Nation, headlining Democrats Remember the Ladies. Mm-hmm. You're you're pointing your fingers at the Democratic Party, and I'll just quote here, yet in this election cycle, we see no Democratic equivalent to the Mama Grizzlies, no energetic retort to the Republicans' anemic claims that they are the party of women. And I think one of the refrains of this election has been, you know, what are the Democrats doing?
Yes.
But on this issue in particular, I mean, we have Nancy Pelosi, and there's certainly other Hillary Clinton as well. Mm-hmm. There's certainly women in leadership powers, but it has a different kind of dynamic, it seems to me.
Well, the Democrats for decades, have been running away from their reputation as a feminized party, from what was dubbed some decades ago the mommy party, which was not meant as a compliment, quite obviously. And they've gotten this reputation because there's been a gender gap that has favored Democrats for a long time. So what the Republicans are doing now is trying to rebrand their party and their female candidates to make themselves the party of women. The thing that is frustrating to me is that at this moment, the Democrats are still relying on what, again, I think is dated, out of date, conventional wisdom that voters and the public and the media don't respond to things that are powerful and feminine by continuing to distance themselves from their reputation, which is one that's based in truth. Women are the Democratic base. There are fantastic, dynamic women in the Democratic Party. Democrats passed Lilly Ledbetter fair pay legislation. It was the first legislation passed in the Obama administration. We don't hear a peep about it.
They don't embrace it.
They don't embrace it. Democrats behave as though they're vaguely embarrassed and resentful of their of their women. And this, for me, is endlessly maddening and frustrating, especially when it seems that what the Republicans are responding to, because we've always had conservative women, and of course there is an attempt to rebrand here and to advertise themselves, and in some, through some arguments, falsely advertise themselves as the party of women. But what Republicans seem to have heard is that there is a changing and growing appetite and engagement for issues of gender, power, and politics. And the Democrats are still thinking that it's 10 years ago and nobody wants to hear about women in power. That's not true anymore, and my own party can't seem to hear those messages.
And that's Rebecca Traister, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about women in politics, something that she writes about, as a senior writer for Salon, and she's got a new book called Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Shannon from Bryn Mawr joining us on Radio Times. And Shannon, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Great. It's great to hear this conversation.
Great.
Because this is a very difficult election for me and my larger group of friends. And I wanted to hear your response to what I was saying to the women in my life who were supporting Hillary. I was telling them the reason I wasn't supporting Hillary was twofold. I didn't think she could win. I thought that what she went through during the Clinton administration, right or wrong, the right wing had really successfully demonized her to the point that I thought she could never win in November. And then my other argument was, do you really want the first woman president to be someone who started off as a first lady and who came to power, in a way, through her husband? Wouldn't it be better for the first woman president to be a Barbara Boxer or someone else, someone who we never knew who her husband was?
Well, Shannon, I'm having a flashback as you call into Radio Times. Let me give Rebecca Traister a chance to respond. I'm sure you've heard this.
Oh, I have heard it, and it's a fascinating question and not one with an easy answer. As to your first point, the question of whether or not you thought Hillary could win, that was a very valid concern. Look, I harbored the same concern. I actually did think she probably could win. I still think she might win in the future. I think her chances are even higher of winning in the future. But as to the thornier question of, and it was phrased in lots of different ways, including the accusation that she was part of a political dynasty. The thing I would point out is that for generations in this country, for generations, there was no path for women to take if they wanted to get to political power. And then for women of Hillary's generation, there was still no obvious path if you had an interest in becoming a political figure, let alone an elected official. One of the only paths available, actually, to women in politics was through their male partner. Mm-hmm. And that's why you see it's not just Hillary. If you look at any number of the female senators and female congresswomen, and there are only 17% of them, you will see a shocking number of them who are widows of their husbands who held their seats, whose husbands or brothers or fathers, Nancy Pelosi's father was in politics. That's because there were simply not other paths. This is also true around the world, by the way. Many of the other countries that have had women leaders, those women leaders have also been the wives, widows, daughters, sisters of male leaders. It's imperfect. Wouldn't it be great if we did have somebody who was sort of sui generis her own candidate? But that's just not been an impossibility. Mm-hmm. And I think that I think it's Obama, let's not let the perfect stand in the way of the good. This comes into play with women candidates. We have, when you're shut out of power, you get to have a fantasy about how great it would be if you had the power. And that's how we got fantasies about women. The first woman president would never start a war, and she'd pull over and ask for directions, and she'd be cooperative and collaborative and sweet and nurturing, and there'd be no corruption. And of course, you get to have that fantasy only because you don't get to have the reality.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And those expectations for perfection stood in the way of Hillary. Lots of women and feminists said, I wanted her to be better, and didn't support her at the start. And we have to get over those high expectations for how perfect somebody could be.
But going back to these Republican women, it seems that many of them, or certainly a good number of them, are in positions of power through their own right. I'm thinking again about a Sarah Palin or
a Carly Fiorina or a Meg Whitman.
Exactly.
I mean, what you're looking, or Linda McMahon. I mean, she's associated with her husband's wrestling empire. But yes, this is. But what we're looking at also is a new generation of women. What I said before about these opportunities coming through partnership with a male mate really does apply to a generation that Hillary Clinton belongs to, that also, I argue in my book, Elizabeth Edwards belongs to. I always thought Elizabeth Edwards really wanted to be the president more than John, and like Hillary, had sort of lashed her political fortunes to an unwieldy mate. But what we're looking at is a new generation. That's one of the reasons that people like Sarah Palin, and not just those women on the right, there are women on the left. Alex Sink in Florida, one of my favorite candidates going into these midterms. Crystal Ball, a Virginia congressional candidate who has an unfortunate name and has had an unfortunate path so far. Young women, she's 28. If she were elected, she would be the youngest woman in Congress, the only one under 30. You're looking at new kinds of paths opening up, in part because of the candidacies of somebody like Hillary Clinton. So again, you can't look at these things in a vacuum. Hillary Clinton may be of a generation where she had to have been married to a president in order to try to be a president, but she inspires other women from other parties to get into it through different avenues.
Shannon, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And there were rumors a couple of weeks ago that Barack Obama was considering Hillary Clinton as his vice presidential candidate, running mate for the next election. That's been squashed, and we're almost up in a break here, but how do you read the rumor mill related to that?
That rumor mill has been in operation since before Obama was inaugurated. I heard that rumor that there was going to be a switch literally before he took office. I don't know that there's any truth in it. I also think it'd be a great idea.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's one of the most popular politicians in America right now. And the truth is, there is a possibility that she'll run in 2016. And Obama and his administration do need to present an heir. And there could be another one we've not even heard of. Nobody had heard of Barack Obama before 2004, and he was president in 2009. So there could be any number of other Democrats who are going to come up and surprise us. But at the moment, Hillary remains one of the most popular Democrats out there, in part because she lost the presidency, let's not forget.
And she looks like she's enjoying being Secretary of State.
She's enjoying being Secretary of State. She is, as usual, working well with others within the administration. And I think it would set her up well, and it would help him a lot. He'd get all the Hillary energy, the 18 million cracks, out of their armchairs to vote for him.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Rebecca Traister, author of Big Girls Don't Cry, the election that changed everything for American women. We'll take some more calls and also talk about the press coverage, and that will give us a lot to discuss. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by PNC Wealth Management, dedicated to helping customers achieve more by crafting personalized solutions to grow, preserve, and transfer their wealth. More information is available from John Conaway at 215-585-5438.
Pifaro supports WHYY. Prince Frederick was baptized in 1616, his parents threw a two-week dance party. Pifaro's recreation takes place Saturday, October 23rd, and repeats Sunday, October 24th, with the baptism from 5 to 6, and after dinner, the ballet from 8 to 9. Guests include the New York Historical Dance Company, Parthenia Strings, and Boston's Blue Heron Choir. Delaware patrons travel on Piffero's Royal Celebration Bus. Details at piffero.com or 215-235-8469.
QuakerQuest supports WHYY and invites you to a series of conversations that explore peace, justice, equality, and simplicity in our world today. QuakerQuest discussion series shares the ways of nonviolence and social justice for every community we live in. QuakerQuest sessions will be held at the Art Street Meeting House in Philadelphia on October 24th, 31st, and November 7th. Parking and childcare are provided. To attend one or all sessions, phillyquakerquest.org.
The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY, featuring hand-knotted rugs made by fairly paid adults. Online at rugs.10000villages.com. 10,000 Villages. Quality you desire. Fairness artisans deserve.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking about politics, women in politics, with our guest Rebecca Traister, senior writer at Salon.com and author of Big Girls Don't Cry. And we've got a full bank of calls here. I do want to go back to the callers, but let's first talk about Chris Matthews. Mm. And you certainly
everybody
have,
wants to talk about Chris Matthews,
including Chris Matthews,
including Chris Matthews.
But you certainly criticize him in this book for some of his comments about Hillary Rodham Clinton. But I'd like you to compare what's coming out of his mouth as he talks today about Sarah Palin.
Well, and Christine O'Donnell, Chris Matthews had a zinger a couple weeks ago. I believe on the night that Christine O'Donnell won the Delaware primary, he announced that it was the power of the women's vote, which could not have been more inaccurate or more of a misreading of why Christine O'Donnell won in Delaware. It had nothing to do with a women's vote. But it really, and I don't mean to make Chris Matthews the poster boy for what essentially is a media that has been long run by white men. And that's just true. That's not me being defensive or hyper radical feminist or anything. That's what the
God
media
forbid,
has been.
Right.
And there were a lot of men in the media and some women in the media, who did not know, had zero sensitivity to issues of gender. And again, not sensitivity like sweet man sensitivity, like didn't understand the first thing about the challenges presented to women as they present themselves as public political figures, and didn't understand how their amplified resentments and negativity toward Hillary Clinton might be tied in, even on a purely unconscious level, to her gender. There was sort of no awareness of that. And that's a lot of what we saw in what was sort of largely called the sexist treatment of Hillary Clinton. A lot of it was probably entirely unconscious, but reflected exactly the kind of resistance, attitudes, and resentments that have long made it difficult to impossible for women to run for president.
But you know, at the same time, and I remember this was before the Biden-Palin debate, and even a debate a week or so ago with Christine O'Donnell, and the question was, will this male candidate be too mean, or will he have to sort of, you know, hold his fire because she's a woman? I mean, we heard that.
Oh, we did hear it. We did hear it. We heard it last week, not just with O'Donnell, but also about the Reid-Engel debate and the McMahon. I mean, and it's this funny thing.
Because you don't want to be seen as, quote unquote, beating up on a
woman. You don't want to beat up on a woman. And then you have Maureen Dowd talking about how the women are mean girls. I mean, we can't get straight who's mean and who's a bully and who's unpleasant. But the one thing I will say about the treatment of, by a lot of the guys in the media, of Sarah Palin and Christine O'Donnell versus the treatment of Hillary, a lot of how they talked about Hillary was demonizing her. She was, gave her the respect of actually being terrified of her, which was she was going to mess things up for the Democratic Party. She was going to mess things up for Obama. She was this emasculating, threatening Sherman tank of a candidate. And the way they talk about Palin and Christine O'Donnell, who we should note are younger and more conventionally attractive, is with a kind of hooting and barely disguised lascivious derision. And I heard that the night O'Donnell won her primary again in Delaware, I heard so much commentary coming from men on the in the left media sort of just laughing at her, treating her like a punchline. Oh, she's so stupid. Essentially just coming up short of calling her a bimbo. They did not use the word bimbo. I don't want to suggest that they did. But that was the attitude, this dumb girl. And I was so mad. And I, again, there's not a word that has ever come out of Christine O'Donnell's mouth that I agree with. And there is so much about her that you can validly go after and criticize, that why we need to take the attitude of condescension and treating her like she's a joke. And I just thought, she just won her primary. You guys were wrong about her. Mm-hmm. Last night, you would have said you'd never talk about her again. And tonight, she's won the Delaware primary. So in fact, it's not you showing her up. It's her, in a funny way, showing you up. And they didn't seem to get that. She was still a joke. She's just a joke.
Well, let me throw something else in, then we will get back to our callers. Because interestingly, and you talk about Katie Couric and Tina Fey and what they did in the 2008 election, but think of Rachel Maddow, her mm-hmm. ascendance, and certainly Christine Amanpour, who now has her own show on Sunday. Even the power of The View, where mm-hmm. they get the president to come and sit on Candy Crowley on CNN. So we're seeing more and more women in the media. I don't know if that changes the conversation
or not. Oh, it absolutely changes the conversation, and it changes the number of people. One conversation I had recently, the very brilliant pundit, Melissa Harris-Lacewell, who's actually, I believe now, Melissa Harris Perry. She just changed her name. She got married. Rachel Maddow has sort of made a star of Melissa Harris Perry. And, you know, Maddow's presence changes the whole conversation. Joy Behar, The View, changes the whole conversation. And what it is if you have, this is the sort of explosive, stone-skipping power of what happens if you have a woman running for president, for instance. Then you need to turn to the very few women in your media to help explain her and talk about the issues that she might face. So then you have an increased presence of women in the media, like Katie Couric, who then gets to interview Sarah Palin. Then you might have a woman who's the first head writer of Saturday Night Live, Tina Fey, who right. happens to look like the vice presidential candidate, which could have never happened before because there'd never been a vice presidential candidate who looked like a woman before, who was a woman. And then you have Tina Fey, who's in a position, because she's been a history-making woman in a totally different field, to lampoon the vice presidential candidate in the Saturday Night Live tradition of Chevy Chase Dana
meta,
Carvey.
It's very meta,
but it really shows exactly how these waves work. It doesn't happen just in the area of the presidency. It moves out to every field.
Let me get back to our callers, but just another quick quote from your book. If Katie Couric was the nail in Sarah Palin's vice presidential coffin, the hammer was Tina Fey. Just underscoring what you just said. Let me get Holly from Reading to join us on Radio Times. And Holly, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks. Rebecca, I really have enjoyed this conversation, and I'm looking forward to your book.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a corporate leadership coach, and I see a big shift right now in corporate leadership training to a more strength-based leadership approach. Regardless of someone's individual strengths, whether they're sort of stereotypically masculine, like direct, unemotional, authoritative, or stereotypically feminine, collaborative, asking questions, building trust, those kinds of things. And focusing on people's strengths right now, no matter what they are, no matter if they're masculine or feminine, or whether they're a man or a woman. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how this shift in corporate leadership training really may ultimately have an impact on politics, and it's probably a good segue from the questions or comments that you just made about.
Well, that's interesting, Holly. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Well, if I'm understanding you correctly, Holly, what you're saying is that, so even if a woman's strength, even if a female corporate person's strength is nurturing, they're emphasizing that now.
And the idea
instead of urging her to take on more stereotypically male characteristics. That is absolutely a process we saw take place over the arc of even Hillary Clinton's campaign, when she did start out in that kind of passing for male mode. And by the end, by the very end, she was able to make a feminist statement in her concession speech, which was probably only because she was in the moment of loss. She was able to say, we made 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling. But leading up to that, she finally dumped Mark Penn, and over the course of that arc, by the time she was campaigning, for instance, here in Pennsylvania, she was working on Hillary Clinton's strengths, which were not necessarily,
well,
they
thing.
Were not hyper-feminized in ways we might have thought of hyper-feminized qualities, but she was herself, her female self. She was talking with more emotion. She was using a voice that was very much more comfortable to her, and that was an evolution that happened over the course of her campaign. And now, of course, what we are seeing with the Republican women and with many of the Democratic women who are running this year is that they too are being far more open. This is a revolution. They're being far more open about the fact that they're women, whether they're self-celebrating or whether they're simply calling out sexist actions. This is also revolutionary. It has just happened with Meg Whitman, who responded to Jerry Brown's aide calling her a whore. It had been unheard of for a female candidate to ever respond directly to what might be misogynist criticism of any kind, because you don't want to look like a victim. You don't want to be, you know, you don't want to be defensive and be the victim of sexism. Well, that is a change that we're seeing. Meg Whitman just came out and said, you know, this is a terrible thing that was said about me, and this goes back to a history of things that are said about women. And Crystal Ball, again, this Virginia congressional candidate, did the same thing when pictures of her as a 22-year-old at a stupid party involving her ex-husband and a stupid thing on his nose. She said, she came out with a hyper-feminist response, and I think that's sort of what you're talking about. It's about owning the fact that you're female, the fact that there's gendered resistance to you, and saying, I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to address it and turn it into a strength.
Holly, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get Jay from Florida to join us. And Jay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, great topic.
Thanks.
One thing I wanted to mention, you know, there is no affirmative action in politics. If you want to aspire to office, you have to be elected. You're still subject to the will of the people. And I thought I remembered a survey some time back that a lot of women do not trust women in office. So it's a little unfair to blame the men and the men in the media. They say dumb things about dumb men in politics just like they say things about dumb people. You're going to put yourself out there, then you're subject to all kinds of criticism, no matter what your gender or race or ethnic origin is.
And Jay, that's a great point, and I don't want you to think that we're beating up on men here. And let me give Rebecca Tracer just a chance to respond.
Yeah, I absolutely want to point out, when I talk, for example, about how the media is male-run, I actually said a few minutes ago some men and some women were making these kinds of comments about women. You're absolutely right. What we have to take apart, though, is how attitudes, for example, attitudes that women have about women candidates, are formed and fostered by the messages we get about them. And you're absolutely right. There is no sexual imperative. There's no gender imperative. I'm not going to vote for, you know, Christine O'Donnell. I don't live in Delaware, but I wouldn't anyway. There's my conversation here is not to suggest that women are supposed to vote for women just because they share secondary sexual characteristics with them. It's that we need to push toward a place where there are more women to vote for and more women to vote against, as well as more racial, ethnic, sexual minorities. And that doesn't mean that there's some sort of gender unity that I'm working toward, just more inclusion.
Well, and Jay, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And that, I think it just taps into how difficult it is just to talk about this, all this stuff. I think people feel either victims or like they're being victimized, or we parse our language so carefully in order to talk about such touchy stuff like race and gender and politics.
And this was one of the things that was so painful during 2008, especially as my at first ambivalent support for Hillary Clinton grew stronger in the spring, and there was so much anger toward her and toward her supporters from Obama supporters who really felt like she and her insistence on staying in the race was screwing things up for them. And in that, I felt, for example, some unconscious misogyny that was extremely painful because it was coming from like-minded people, people I'd always agreed with about politics. And let me tell you, trying to express my feeling that there was misogyny there resulted in rage from those who felt that I was accusing them of being sexist. Mm. Because especially when you're on the left, and this was true in reverse for a lot of Hillary supporters who were being accused of being racist in their resentments toward Obama and his campaign, when you are on the left and you sort of cleanly think of yourself as someone who's cool with all this kind of stuff, to be accused of sexism, to be accused of racism or homophobia or classism is incredibly painful, and the reaction is rage. But this is one of the things we have to come to terms with, is the fact that we can be on the right side of everything and we can be consciously on the right side of everything, and that doesn't mean that our unconscious doesn't produce reactions that are amplified or twisted by our unconscious feelings about power and
prejudice. All that bubbling psychology.
Yes.
There. Jay, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Rebecca Traister, our guest today on the show, we are talking about politics, and her new book is called Big Girls Don't Cry. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
And sometimes tolerance is just a word, it seems. Very interesting conversation here on Radio Times. As always, have really enjoyed this last hour, which took us right back to the exciting times in 2008 when it really wasn't clear who's going to be our presidential candidate. My name is Mike and Scott. I'm a reporter here at WHYY. With me is Dennis Devine. He's one of the producers for Radio Times, actually put together the very hour we were just listening to. Ooh, that was a web ping. That brings me to why we are here. We are here because it is our fall membership campaign for WHYY. What you just heard was somebody making a pledge at WHYY.org, and we invite you to be the next person to do the same, to support everything that we do here at WHYY, the thoughtful kinds of discussions that we enjoy on Radio Times. Dennis, what appealed to you about this hour and this guest?
Well, Rebecca is a real up-and-coming writer, and she came out with a book that in some respects you could look at and say, oh, well, you know, haven't we talked enough about the election 2 years ago? But in fact, there's a whole lot more to mine, as I think this great hour of discussion has proved. And Marty wanted to sort of look back and look forward. I mean, we're right in the midst of an election season that Radio Times, Marty, we've devote a lot of time to bringing in the candidates, talking to political analysts, really looking at one aspect of it, which is the increasing prominence and really interesting roles played by women on electoral ballots all across the country, especially Republican women this election season. So Rebecca was a wonderful way. Rebecca's book, Big Girls Don't Cry, and her as a guest was a wonderful opportunity for us to talk and go further in depth on those issues. Now, you listening at home, in your car, at your office, I know that's what you appreciate about Marty, about Radio Times, about WHYY. And so I'm going to ask you to call in, to not be just a listener, but to make yourself a supporter as well. So, and you can do that by calling 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. And as Mike said, as you're hearing these little pings here or there, those are online contributions on our website, whyy.org.
And, you know, Dennis, it's also interesting. Sometimes you need a little bit of distance to really talk about an issue. So now we have 2 years between that primary race and now, and that gives you that distance to kind of revisit the issues and talk about them, and everybody is a little bit less emotional, a little bit less heated about that particular issue. So it gives you a lot of great insight. So that was fun to kind of go back in time a bit and revisit that. And Radio Times offers you a wonderful array of conversations, 2 hours every day during the week, where you can really learn about so many different things. We have a lot of fun on the show as well, with great performers, with entertainers, with writers. A lot of serious issues. Today was definitely one of the more serious days, sure. And a lot of politics, and we learned about global power in the first hour. Radio Times is everything that you could possibly want from a magazine show on the radio, with a great host and a great staff. And it lives right here on WHYY, thanks mostly to your ongoing support. Radio Times has had a lot of fans who've listened to the show for years and some of them decades now, and they've all